In sci-fi stories, movies, television shows, robots perform all sorts of tasks that humans routinely perform. Well, the android Data on Star Trek The Next Generation played the violin and painted. Computers think for themselves. Some are self-aware. But how close are scientists to actually producing these kinds of thinking and doing machines? What are some of the obstacles? Why do we want to do this? Think about this for a moment. Imagine if you had to mentally command all of the muscles in your body involved in taking a single step. Think about that for a moment. We walk and run, probably don't even know which muscles do what. Well, now you're getting the picture. This hour, we'll talk about robots and the challenges inherent in making them more like us. My guest is senior New York Times science writer John Markoff, whose recent New York Times article, In Search of a Robot More Like Us, was the genesis for this discussion. John Markoff, good morning and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
The idea of artificially intelligent mechanical contrivances has fascinated humankind for centuries. Why do you think that is?
That's a very hard question. I grew up on science fiction. And so it was simply part of the territory that was this bright, shiny future. Why it fascinated people centuries ago, I'm not quite sure. Being able to animate a dead corpse, I guess, was a long part of the literature. Having control over vast armies of sort of half-alive creatures was part of the literature, but I can't answer that question, I guess.
I mean, Da Vinci had drawings for a mechanical man run by clockwork. I was just wondering if, at least in some respects, if you accept any of the creation stories from whichever religion you happen to prefer. Is man trying to imitate God? We want to create some life or something like us, something in our own image?
I really have difficulty going back into early history, but as recently as the 1960s, there has been just sort of a widespread desire. In our society, particularly to augment the human mind, to extend what we can do, everything from computer science to psychedelic drugs have been used to try to expand our minds. I think maybe there's something innately human about that.
Well, it's certainly fascinating, and I don't have an answer to that question myself. I've often wondered, what is it about that's so appealing? But we'll set that aside for now. Maybe one of our callers will jump in with a more philosophical view.
Well, one of the things that I discovered in reporting a book about the roots of the personal computer around Stanford in the 1960s, there were two laboratories, two computer science laboratories on either side of Stanford campus in the early 1960s, from which grew much of what is the modern personal computer and the Internet. And what struck me in sort of going back and looking at what they were doing and why they were doing it is that one of the labs, John McCarthy's lab — John McCarthy was a computer scientist, is a computer scientist who embedded the concept of artificial intelligence, and he created the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in 1964 in the foothills behind Stanford, and he really was intent on replacing the human. They thought it was about a decade-long project in 1964. And on the other side of campus was Douglas Engelbart's lab. You probably know Engelbart because he was, among other things, the inventor of the mouse. But philosophically, Engelbart was really intent upon augmenting the human mind. He thought that you could put together these computerized tools. He created an online system, which was really the predecessor to the modern Internet. And his idea was sort of bootstrapping human intelligence through a small group of people who were augmented by computerized tools. And I was really struck by that sort of philosophical distinction on either side of the campus.
Well, I want to get to what I thought, at least, maybe I missed this, but that was the crux of your article, and I want to do that up front, which may not be a good journalistic strategy. But humans and other living things have developed nervous, muscle, and skeletal systems that perform without the benefit of conscious thought. We don't have to think about all the muscles, tendons, bones, etc., that have to move so we can, for example, put a fork full of food into our mouths. We have an enormous amount of hand-eye coordination. How does that transfer to robotics?
Well, not so well, as it turns out. One of the things that that struck me, you know, there was so much attention given to IBM's Watson computer that beat the best human players recently, earlier this year, in the game Jeopardy. You know, it had a vast database and it had some natural language capabilities. And, you know, that was sort of seen as a milestone in this tradition. At the same time, I was talking to a number of roboticists because I wanted to sort of see where we were with sort of building robotic hands and arms. And, you know, the simplest thing for a human being, reaching into your pocket, grabbing a quarter with your, or looking through your change and figuring out what the quarter is and bringing it out and twirling it between your fingers, you can largely do without any, you know, active thought process. It's almost muscle memory. A computer, we're nowhere near building a computer that could do anything like that. And that was just a striking, a striking contradiction to me, that the computers could do so well in such a narrow field and have so much trouble with very basic human activities.
Why is that? Where is the where's the big challenge? Where's the big obstacle here?
Well, I think that that things that you know, we do through muscle memory and sort of the brain's ability to perceive the environment turn out to be computationally very intensive. I mean, even though you're not actively thinking about it, there's a lot of computing going on, and it's what they call mixed mode. I mean, you're able to do a tremendous amount by simply your sense of touch, and you know, there's no active thought at all in that. And at the same time, you have this great sense of the space around you, and trying to build robotic systems that can begin to mimic that is I think still years and years away. It's hard to predict how many years because these technologies are not changing in a linear fashion. But I think if you want to get a good sense of how hard that kind of basic human stuff is for robots in unstructured environments, go look at a YouTube video put up on the web by researchers at the computer science department at UC Berkeley. They got access to a robot from Willow Garage, a company who makes prototype robots in Menlo Park, and their goal is to teach the robot how to unload the washing machine and then put the clean clothes out on the table and then fold them. And there's this wonderful video of a robot folding a set of towels, and it's just the most, it's just captivating. You can't take your eyes off it because it's so anthropomorphic. And then you look below the video and you realize that it's been sped up 50 times. And so it's really, in real time, it's just this painstakingly slow process of something we do just, you know, in a very fluid fashion. And that, I think, is a good indicator of how far they have to go.
Because the robot has to control all the individual pieces of all of those motions, one calculation at a time.
Well, it's more than that. It has to do that, but it also has to perceive its environment. And it has a very, very narrow repertoire for perceiving its environment. We have this very holistic sense of the environment around us, and the robot, you know, it's done the towels, but it still hasn't figured out how to do the shirts because it doesn't understand on some sort of a deeper level what the difference is between a towel and a shirt. So, you know, the science fiction stuff, I mean, I think another thing that struck me about sort of where we are is that General Motors cooperated with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to build this humanoid robot from the torso up, and Robonaut 2 is now up on the space shuttle. But when I called them to sort of ask, you know, how Robonaut 2 was doing, they had a launch window. The hardware for Robonaut 2 was completed, but the programming for the robot was still, probably years behind. So they sent the robot up there, but the robot can't really do much. And I thought that was indicative of where we are.
Hmm. I wonder what our listeners think about this. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Your chance to call in and give your take on, well, what do you think about robotics and where this may be headed? Do you like the idea of scientists inventing robots that can do everything that human beings can do? What do you think about the whole concept, for example, of artificial intelligence? And where do you come down on this discussion? 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. My guest is senior New York Times science writer John Markoff, whose recent New York Times article, In Search of a Robot More Like Us, gave us the idea to do this program in the first place. John Markoff, your article talks about a debate over how to design a machine flexible enough to do the things that humans do. I'm wondering, what are the issues in this debate?
Well, there are many. I mean, there are sort of deep philosophical issues, and then there are very straightforward economic ones. I mean, one of the issues about the deployment of all kinds of automation technologies is they tend to displace jobs. And I think that, you know, if you talk to almost any economist in the United States today, which I tried to talk for an earlier article, I tried to look around the economics community and see where they were on the issue of automation. And the general perception is that new technologies historically have displaced jobs. I mean, look at agriculture. I think once we were largely an agrarian country, and now we're, I think agricultural labor is something like 1 to 1.5% of the working population. The economists, by and large, argue that the workforce changes, but net overall, more jobs are created than displaced. And, you know, I think they don't have a good idea of this. They don't have a complete understanding of what we call in Silicon Valley Moore's Law, that a whole set of technologies are not advancing in a linear fashion, that the increases in computer power and storage and relatively large number of other technologies is moving in a nonlinear fashion, that these increases are exponential, and it's more difficult to predict their consequences because of those kinds of changes. There's even a crowd in Silicon Valley that believe in this notion of what's called the singularity. Science fiction writer Werner Vinge a number of years ago believed that we would have self-conscious machines sometime after 2020 because of the rate of the improvement of computer technologies. And I'm not so sure about that, but I do believe that when technological change happens in a nonlinear fashion, it's very difficult to predict the consequences. And for example, earlier this year, I wrote about how these systems based on AI technologies are beginning to displace jobs at the top of the labor force, not just routinized mechanical labor, but, you know, our corporations have largely been hollowed out by software. I mean, there was an entire stratum of middle-class jobs, the middle of the workforce, that is now gone because those functions have been automated by technologies we no longer call artificial intelligence, but are doing things that human beings once did. And what I found was, even in at the very high end of the workforce, like legal profession, in legal discovery, you used to have rooms full of humans, paralegals and lawyers paid as much as $300 or $400 an hour, who would read the material in lawsuits. And they are very rapidly being replaced by software that does the same thing. And that was very striking to me.
We're talking about robots and building a more human robot with my guest is John Markoff, senior New York Times science writer. And with you, 800-486-8655. There's room for you to get in right now. Lines are wide open, 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook and leave a comment there, and we'll pass it along to the listeners. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is senior New York Times science writer John Markoff, whose latest book is What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer Industry. He recently wrote an article in the New York Times science section titled In Search of a Robot More Like Us, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of the program. We have calls waiting, but before we get to those, I wanted to just toss this out there. Is there a chicken and egg component to the discussion of trying to make robots that are more like us?
And what's the egg?
Yeah, what is the chicken and what is the egg? I mean, you know, what do we need to invent first, apparently? I don't know.
I think that you know, there are lots of interesting research projects that deal with creating robots that have emotions and robots that behave in all kinds of anthropomorphic ways. Putting it all together and making a machine that could independently move around in the environment, I think is, you know, I know this person has been a long time observer of Silicon Valley, Paul Saffo, and he's fond of saying, never mistake a clear view with a short distance. And I think that applies to this problem.
Okay, let's go to the phones, take some calls. We'll start with Bruce in Holman. Oh, excuse me, Joel in Appleton. You'll be first. Joel, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I got a question for you regarding, you know, kind of maybe a little bit of a twist on this. As we're trying to create robots that can mimic the human beings, you know, and like the functionality of our brains, how is that driving our increasing our understanding of how our brains work, and what are we learning about ourselves from this drive to, or how much is this contributing to us learning about the functioning of our brains?
I think that there is a great deal of research that sort of crosses over, that attempts to take things that you know, we can see in our own biology and apply it to the way machines work. There are research groups who are looking that I've spoken to that are looking into the way we can educate ourselves by using machines to work with the early childhood developmental education, the act of learning language. You know, it's class oriented, and there is some thinking that if you could put a robot to compensate for things that are missed in certain environments, that would give children an added benefit as they develop. I think there's there's probably even farther to go in learning how the human brain functions than the challenge of creating machines that mimic it. There's a famous experiment proposed many, many years ago by Alan Turing, an early computer designer, in defining what is artificial intelligence. And Turing had this notion that if you put two keyboards in front of a person and you allowed that person to ask conversational questions to each of those at each of those keyboards, you could have been said to have created an artificial intelligence if you couldn't tell which keyboard there was a machine and which keyboard there was a human being. And I have to tell you, as long ago as I think it was 1988 or 1989, maybe 1990, the first Turing test competition where people would write software and try to pass this test, they divided the audience into judges that they got off the street and judges who were computer scientists. And for people off the street, we passed the Turing test many years ago. It was difficult for people who didn't have a technical understanding to sort of really tell whether they were typing to a machine or typing to a human being, which was, I thought, intriguing and perhaps frightening thing to realize.
Joel, thanks for the call. How far away do you think we are from the kind of artificial intelligence described by, say, William Gibson in Neuromancer?
Well, he talks about real sentient beings, and that, you know, what I think, you know, one of the luxuries of being a reporter is I simply have to report what other people think, and I don't have to make those kinds of visionary statements. My guess is that actual sentient machines are not going to show up this century, although there are people in Silicon Valley who believe, who are, you know, technically qualified and well-known people who believe it will be quicker than that.
Let's Joel, thanks for the call. Let's go next. This time we'll get Bruce in Holman on the line. Bruce, good morning. Thanks for holding.
Hello. Yeah, I've long held the belief that the development of artificial intelligence and its application to creating intelligent machines is probably the next evolutionary step for the human race. To me, it seems pretty obvious that barring, you know, some you know, wonderful change in attitude, we're going to destroy this planet as far as supporting biological life, and that if we want to leave any sort of a legacy or a heritage of what was the human race, it'll be through our descendants, which I personally think will be intelligent machines that perhaps will look back nostalgically on their long extinct human creators.
May I comment?
Go ahead, please.
So, you know, I think I'm very sympathetic with that view. I you know, that's sort of the best possible outcome. I can see lots of things that can go wrong. You know, Ray Kurzweil is well known for this notion of the singularity, this vast acceleration in these technologies that lead to super intelligent machines. And if that's true, I mean, now we're sort of deeply into the realm of science fiction, but if that's true, I think it's unpredictable how they're going to view us. And I think we could, you know, run into, before we reach that stage, let's assume that we're going there, which I think is, the time at which we might get to machines that have those kinds of capabilities, I think is very, very difficult to predict. But I think there are lots of issues. Employment was just one, but you can also think about warfighting robots. I mean, once upon a time, we were, the science fiction community was compelled by Asimov's three laws of robotics that, you know, we could design these machines that would not harm human beings. And it's already pretty clear that these, you know, the AI technologies that we have are being used as efficiently and effectively by people who design robots that that kill and do similar things. That the notion of ethical robots, I think, is probably wishful science fiction. So, the kind of society that we might get, you know, whether we would evolve into this sort of a more advanced and more rational society, it's not clear to me that that it's going to get better. I guess. I mean, clearly we're going to evolve, and it's clear that that these machines will become more a part of the way in which we evolve, but whether that society will look like one we want to live in is an open question to my mind.
Bruce,
I guess I started an optimist, and I'm not as optimistic as I was perhaps two or three decades ago.
Okay. Well, I think that may be true of many of us. Bruce, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Mark in Racine. Mark, good morning.
Hello. I can barely hear you over the telephone. Hopefully you can hear me.
I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Things. Hello?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, Bruce and any other listener might be interested in reading Stanislaw Lem's book, The Siberiad. It's a hilarious post-human being, robots on a sort of a Baron von Munchausen missions. It's pretty funny. I would like you to talk about expert systems. They are using computers now to quiz experts on medicine, things like that. And so if somebody wants to know something about brain chemistry or something like that, they can actually contact a computer and put in queries, and the computer will then give you kind of a tree of options, and will answer questions and lead you on to other questions to help you locate the specifics of a diagnosis you want, say. If you know about that, I'd appreciate it if you'd talk about that.
Sure. I think you're on to actually a much bigger thought here than expert systems. I mean, if you go back to the early days of artificial intelligence design and research, stuff that happened at Stanford as early as the 1960s and around MIT, people were trying to design these expert systems, and they thought that they would soon be partners or perhaps even replace human beings. And it's turned out to build expert systems that aren't brittle, that that can, you know, that can actually do useful things has been more difficult, as many of these things are, in the same way as robotics. I mean, there are, for example, efforts going back 3, 4, 5 decades to build medical expert systems, and yet doctors are only now using sort of online reference systems, and I think that there are not a lot of medical professionals yet. Although, you know, that's one of the things that IBM has said publicly they want to do with Watson is deploy it as an expert system for doctors. And so that's beginning to happen right now. But I think there's a broader thought here about expert systems, and that is if you look at the evolution of computer interfaces, you know, the way we interact with machines, we went from sort of typing at keyboards to interacting with mice. And I think you can rapidly see that all of the major companies that sort of build the software that billions of humans use, Apple and Google and Microsoft, are working on conversational interfaces. And by that I mean, so, you know, we now, the computers we now use are now not easy to interact with. We hold them in the palm of our hands and it's hard to type the letters in. And I think that it's already true with the Google Android. You can interact with that by speaking to it and it does a remarkably good job. Steve Jobs has spent $250 million buying a company that has that technology, and he's clearly going to put it into either the next generation or the generation after that iPhone, and Microsoft is moving that way as quickly as possible. It is a certainty to me that we will interact with machines by speaking to them, and they will answer our questions. You can already see this. This is one of these wonderful sort of non-intuitive things that's happening in terms of the deployment of technology. I would argue you can already find outsourced call centers that have gone to the Philippines and India that have come back to the United States to run as software in America, in American data centers. For example, try to make a reservation, a simple airline reservation, using something like Expedia or using United's speech recognition system. I would argue it's already easier to make a simple phone reservation by speaking to a machine than it is to do it on a computer. And that technology is evolving very quickly. The thing that I don't think people realize, so I think if you look back and you remember how when ATM machines first were introduced, we tended to reject them. We had a quality relationship with our banker, the teller, and we didn't want to give that up. But within a very short period of time, people realized that the relationship wasn't that real on one hand, and that the machine was a more efficient way to get our money and do our banking. And I think that I'm seeing the same thing happen with voice response systems. I mean, there's initially tremendous irritation at these systems that were so stupid and that were hard to use. And I think that's going to go away. The systems are rapidly going to become more facile. And I think the really scary thing at it, if you look at the evolution of speech synthesis technology, the ability to build systems that you know can speak text, and they're rapidly going to be indistinguishable from human beings over the telephone. And so you'll be able to have a very natural conversation, and we will have to alert you to the fact you're talking to a machine and not a human being. And I think that crossover is coming more quickly than people realize.
Mark, thanks for the call. A line is open for you if you'd like to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The New York Times article is headlined, In Search of a Robot More Like Us. We're talking about the development of new robotic technology and how we're trying to make robots be able to perform a lot of tasks that humans do and sort of take for granted. I was wondering, and this may be a too big a question for one program, but how do you teach a computer intuition?
I'm not enough of a roboticist to answer that question, but intuition. I think that's...
Well, I mean, it just seems counterintuitive that you can write a software program that mimics human intuition.
It does, but what about the notion of the illusion of intuition? How could you tell that the robot was actually being intuitive or it was just pretending to be intuitive? I mean, what is an example? You know, I guess an intuition is basically being able to assemble an idea from a set of smaller ideas. What's your definition of intuition?
Well, I guess some people would say gut feeling or being able to see a set of circumstances and make an interpretation that would not necessarily be based on logic.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back to the old Kirk-Spock arguments in Star Trek, but... that's the way I look at intuition. That's that spark, that sudden flash of insight that humans often get that doesn't really, I guess if you examined it at the atomic level, you might be able to find some logic in there someplace, but we don't always know where that inspiration is going to come from or, why we even react a certain way to certain stimuli.
I agree, and there are examples that I could give you of they have already designed machines that do things that they describe as art, and they have designed machines that do things that are in the field of scientific discovery. They're working on software systems that can develop new insight into fields like mathematics, it's clear that these systems aren't self-aware or anywhere near self-aware, but they can do things that you would, they can begin to touch on things that you would describe as being creative or things that have mm-hmm. been the province of human beings.
Well, I had to throw that in there at some point in the hour, so.
Yeah, I think you could do things. You can do things now that would probably touch on creativity, but I think real intuition probably awaits self-aware machines, and I don't know if we're going to get there.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we have more callers who want to join in the discussion here about robots, and we're looking at into research that scientists are doing to try to make robots that are more like human beings, perform a lot of the tasks that we take for granted, and there's some big challenges there, but the rewards down the line might be also very large as well. My guest is the senior New York Times science writer John Markoff, and his article In Search of a Robot More Like Us was the jumping off point for this morning's discussion. 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook and leave a comment there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is in next after 11 o'clock, and his guests have advice on how to support and care for loved ones living with dementia. That's coming up after the news at 11. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. In this hour, we're talking about robots with John Markoff, senior New York Times science writer. His recent article is titled, In Search of a Robot More Like Us. We have lots of callers, and let's see if I can get to one. I think it's in Racine. Is it Jane? I just lost my call screen again. That happens from time to time. Julie in Darlington. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just find this very interesting because I feel that with the amazing power that we've been given with our muscular structure and just our whole body mechanism, I think it's a real testimony to evolution, saying that there is really no way that that we could have evolved in that in this sense, to, and we will never be able to duplicate what God, our Creator, has made, and I think He's trying to make that evident in our inability to do so.
John Markoff.
I tend to deal with what I can observe and what I can report, and I see a number of interesting things happening in the machines that surround us that are beginning to take on human-like qualities. At the same time, I think it's certainly a long, long way if we ever get to machines that are self-aware and have human capabilities. That said, without crossing that boundary and getting into those philosophical or theological points, I think that we're quickly coming to a point where the machines will do many things that humans have done. I watched last year in a robotics laboratory in Menlo Park a robot that had been trained to look around a room and find standard power outlets. And so it was when it was about to run out of power, it would know when it was low on power, and it could go find the wall outlet and plug itself in. And a person I know who's one of the designers of that system sent a humorous email to his friends and family saying, after they'd succeeded in basically being able to take a robot hand and grab the plug and find the wall outlet and plug itself in, he wrote, "They're free and now they can escape and fend for themselves." And he was being humorous, but clearly that's implicit in that capability of those machines.
Julie, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us this morning. Let's go to Mequon next and hear from Abraham. Good morning.
Hi. Can you skip to the next caller?
Okay. Well, we'll skip Abraham then. We'll go to Ken in Madison.
Hello.
Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Hi. Say, I've been around a while. I'm currently 62, and I remember when I was a kid, my father would talk at the dinner table about how automation was eliminating all these jobs. He was concerned about his own. And in the second or third grade, they showed this movie in school showing how the automation, which eventually led to computers, was eliminating all these jobs, and we were going to have all this extra leisure time, because we'd only be working 20 hours a week instead of 40. And, well, that has never materialized. And I was wondering if you thought if it ever would, as I'm sitting here working quite a bit harder than I did 30 years ago when there was twice as many people here.
I know. That's a great question. I think it assumes a rational society that has some different organization and the deployment of resources than perhaps ours does. It seems that all of the trends seem to be moving in the opposite direction. Those are sort of social and political and economic questions more than they are technological questions. And I've certainly observed the same thing, that the amazing productivity that society has created has not always been distributed in the probably the most optimal way for society. Many, many years ago, Karl Marx had ideas about those things. They're out of favor now. You can certainly see continuing acceleration in the efficiency and the productivity of machines, and ask really basic questions about how we're going to use that added productivity. One of the things that's so interesting to me right now, one of the reasons I started to do this reporting is I wanted to see where we were with the sort of the state of the robotic hand, because I've been told that in terms of completely automating much of factory assembly, the bastion of humanity is the hand. And already you can see systems where in factories the the entire automation and logistics system of the factory is around the fact that it's less expensive to automate the human hand and the perception system that humans have. And you see these factories where they put workers in one place and they move in this really striking constellation, the parts around them, and the humans do the handwork that is too expensive to automate, and everything else is done by machines. And so the question is, when will robotic hands displace human hands, and what will be the economic and factory consequences of that? And I think that they are on the horizon right now, a generation of low-cost and more nimble hands. I mean, they have these remarkable pick-and-place robots called Delta Arms that if you watch them, it's just striking. But what they're doing is they're doing things that are very routine. You know, if the block is in the same place and the block is the same color, they can pick it up and move it faster than a human ever could. But if the parts are odd-shaped and not easily put into a routine structure, then humans are still more efficient. I don't know how long that will be the case.
Ken, thanks for the call. Let's take another call. But before we do that, I just want to mention we do have a line available for you if you'd like to get in on this discussion before the end of the hour. Call right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Or leave a message, a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Mike in Glendale, you'll be next. Mike, good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I was reacting to your discussion about when would, you know, we have a robot or a computer that would exhibit intuition, and I think we already do. I think maybe your definition is a little too restrictive. I mean, all the intuition, you know, means to, I think, most people, and certainly it means that to me, is that you reach a conclusion without all of the data necessary to reach that conclusion in a logical way. And we already have, I mean, for instance, even simple systems like predictive text on a phone exhibit intuition. It's a guess as to what the conclusion is supposed to be without all of the information present. And there are many, many expert systems which do that already. Of course, any medical system is never going to have all the information available, but it's going to reach a conclusion based on a set of data that is less than complete, and that's really all intuition is.
Well, that sounds more like inference to me, but I'll concede the point. John Markoff?
I think it's a good point. I mean, once again, it's a question of definition, but clearly the machines are doing things that are inferential, and maybe they rise to the level of intuition. I didn't want the hour to go by without speaking about my experience with robotic cars, because I've been reporting on the advances in robot cars for the past decade, and it's a good example of the rate of progress and how it may in fact be much more quickly upon us than we realize. I mean, I was given a ride in a robot car, I guess it probably was five or six years ago, that was preparing for DARPA's Grand Challenge, which was this robot race through the deserts of Southern California. And this was a car that had been designed by Stanford engineers, and we crashed at speed. I mean, I'm probably one of the few people who's crashed in a robot, but we were going 20, 25 miles an hour when the robot swerved off the road to avoid what it thought was an obstacle. And the designers, we were lucky. We ended up between two rock piles and in the brush, and we straightened out some of the sensors and put the car back on the road. It was a Volkswagen Touareg, and the software designer in the back seat took out a piece of code that was designed to make the ride more comfortable for human beings, and we took off again across the desert. And then just last year, I was given a 25-minute ride in Google's cars through the streets of Mountain View, and we did not crash. And it was really one of the more striking things that I've done as a reporter, because the machine did not drive like a robot. The machine drove in what I would call a very human manner. It saw and avoided cyclists and pedestrians. It followed the rules of the road. the people I was in the car with only took it off of robot control once during our test drive, and that's when a car was backing up in front of us, and I think they were worried about having a reporter in the car. They didn't want to have an accident, and they were being ultra-cautious. But I think, you know, machines that can move us around more safely than we can are actually much more are closer than we think in terms of being commercially available.
Mike, thanks. Thanks for the call. Paul in Clintonville, you're next. Paul, good morning.
Morning. Hey, I was wondering, in your guest, had he run into any problems, so to speak, with in his explorations with the U.S. government as far as, oh, perhaps looking into things that he thought might be interesting, but the government says, nope, we can't go there, that kind of thing, that might lead you to think there's other things in the works that we're just not going to be aware of?
So that's a great question. There are clearly government programs that I'm not aware of. There's lots and lots of classified information that it's not accessible to me, and there are classified activities, particularly the way we're using. I've been interested in the way we're using AI technologies in our drones in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I've heard things about technologies that are being tested and deployed. I'm not quite sure where you're going with that question. However, you know, I've come around. I actually believe that that the rate of progress in terms of technology development is faster in the open world than it is in what's called the black world. There are a number of reasons for that, but I. You know, if I was going to look for something scary, I might look at Apple and Google and Microsoft before I would look at the CIA and the NSA these days.
Well, the DARPA is, which is the Defense Department's research arm, isn't it? They're financing a lot of the public research.
DARPA is a significant funder, and particularly, you know, in the development of low-cost robot arms, DARPA is the major funder. That's not classified research. DARPA also does classified research, and I'm not privy to that. And, you know, there was the classic DARPA funding effort into the system in the wake of 9/11 called the Total Information Awareness that caused great concern. They basically were trying to find terrorists by going through huge amounts of data and looking for behavioral quirks, and that technology disappeared into what's called the black side of the world, and I know less about it now.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I wanted to get you to go all Michio Kaku on us here at the end, and maybe make a prediction about the future here. Where do you think we're going to be with robotics in, say, 20 to 30 years?
You know, what I love not to do as a reporter is I just have to report on what the other visionaries are saying, and one of the things I found is they're always wrong. So with that caveat, I actually think that robotics will be commonplace. Machines that do useful things, maybe as far as getting the beer from the refrigerator, getting the paper from the front yard, will be with us. If the time frame is 2 to 3 decades, low-cost
robots. Assuming there's still a newspaper to get off the front yard.
And more importantly, and perhaps even weirder is that machines increasingly will be our companions. If a machine can, over the telephone, can speak in a human voice, and we can't tell that it's not human, we've crossed a boundary that I think is perhaps significant in a philosophical way. So they're with us, and I think it will sort of roll out in ways that. Neither the science fiction writers nor journalists nor sociologists quite understand right now.
Well, it seems to me that philosophical discussion would really be one worth having, and it ought to be something we can do here on public radio. Maybe we could get you to come on as part of a panel. You wouldn't have to be the only person there.
I would love to help.
We'll work on that. Well, right now we're out of time for this discussion. I really appreciate you being here this morning. It's been a fascinating hour.
Thank you for having me.
John Markoff is a senior science writer for the New York Times. His most recent book is What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal, computer industry. His article, In Search of a Robot More Like Us, was our jumping-off point for the discussion. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program and handling on-air production duties as well. Stick around. Much more to come on the Ideas Network. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock with more. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn for the next 2 weeks, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.